Welcome back in CBSSports.com College Hoops Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Norlander. I hope you enjoyed that special Tuesday edition with Nate Silver. It's so kind of him to come on. And if you're back on after being introduced by that podcast, Nate was kind enough to send it out to his 470,000 followers. I appreciate that so much. Feel free to subscribe in iTunes. Every Wednesday we do an edition with Jeff Goodman and Gary Parrish. They are the senior college basketball writers for CBSSports.com. And this podcast is a favorite to do every single week because you just never know where we're going to go. But I promise, no realignment talk today. We are staying totally free of that. Plenty of other, yes, plenty of other stuff to get to. Fellas, thanks for coming back in. How are we doing?
I'm well. I've lost my voice at some point, but I don't know how important that is for a podcast.
Probably not that vital. Yeah, Goodman, you doing okay up there in Massachusetts?
Yeah, they're building a couple of closets upstairs right now in my office and a bedroom. So if you hear some banging, it's not me falling. It's just them getting some stuff done here.
All right, per usual, if we hear banging around Goodman's house, we'll do our best to ignore it. A lot of stuff. I will go to Boeheim first, winning 900. You know, when he won 800, it was just, you know, barely over 3 years ago. And back then I was writing for an independent site that I had built called collegehoopsjournal.com, and I wrote a thing on it, and I asked if Boeheim was a top 10 all-time coach. I came to the realization, or at least the premise, that he was, or he is, as of 800. So 900 shouldn't change that. But I know you both have opinions on where Boeheim stands. It's an interesting position with Boeheim, because I've actually heard a lot of, you know, not criticism, but a lot of, hey, listen, Boeheim's great, but by the way, he, you know, he's only has three Final Fours in, what, 36 seasons. You look at what Izzo has done in less than half that time. You know, he's got the one title, but only five Elite Eights. You look at all the coaches that have made a lot more Elite Eights. So the regular season accomplishments are good, but you also got to factor in that Boeheim is so known for November and December not leaving the state, playing the Colgates and the Canisiuses and you know, all the teams within a 150-mile radius of Syracuse. So Goodman wrote on this a little bit and how it actually almost never got to 900. So, Jeff, I'll go to you first, and then, Gary, you can chime in when he's done. Impressions on Boeheim getting to 900 and where he stands.
You know, obviously, Boeheim's a great coach, and he did it all in one spot, which makes it, I guess, that much more special. But I'm very hesitant to put him in the elite group of coaches. And that's, you know, again, Wooden, Kay, Bob Knight. I don't think he's in that group. I'm not even sure he's in the Jim Calhoun group because, again, Calhoun won three national titles. That's ultimately where you kind of make your mark and separate yourself from some of the other really good coaches. You know, I put him in a class with Lute Olson. I went to school at Arizona. Olson won one national title, won almost 800 games, did a great job building a program in a place where it really hadn't been done before. And that's, to me, what Boeheim has done has been special. But we can't overlook the fact that they've kind of struggled by Syracuse standards, by the talent standards that he's brought in over the last 8-9 years since they won the national title with Carmelo. They haven't gone to a Final Four. They've had plenty of issues surrounding the program, whether it's the Bernie Fine issue, whether it's the, you know, Scoop Jardine being accused of point shaving, which nothing ever materialized from it. Fab Mello get kicked off for academics at the end of last year. You've got the Michael Carter Williams situation recently, shoplifting. So, you know, it's a program that, again, you know, Boeheim most recently is probably going to be remembered for the teams that didn't do as much and all the off-court stuff rather than his accomplishments on the court.
Yeah, I think it's weird because if you ask people, you know, for the greatest coaches of all time, you'll get a Wooden and a Krzyzewski and a Bob Knight. I don't know that you would get Jim Boeheim in the top three, even though he's top three in wins. I don't know that you get Jim Boeheim in the top five or maybe not even
10.
In the top
10. Maybe 10.
Yeah. And so, you know, so I wonder how much of this record is a product of non-league scheduling and just longevity, as opposed to actual real accomplishments, which is not to diminish what he's been able to do. Again, only three people have ever won 900 games. But I think the average fan probably, I don't want to say dismisses it, but maybe discounts it a little bit based on the lack of championships, lack of Final Fours, and his reputation for scheduling on the weak side in terms of the non-league portion of his slate of games. That said, I do think what we saw the other night is something that we will never see again. Not that we'll never see somebody else win 900 games, because that's going to happen, particularly when we're playing more games than we used to every year. And, you know, you've got guys like, you know, Brad Stevens and Shaka Smart stacking wins at such a young age. And unless they choose to retire at 50 or 55, they're going to be in this sport for a long, long time. And if they're in this sport for a long, long time, they're going to win a whole bunch of games. But I don't think anybody's ever going to win 900 games at the same school again. I don't think it's practical or even reasonable from a coach's perspective to try to stay at the same school for 30 plus years. I don't think you can do it in an era when guys are making so much money, which brings along so much pressure, when there's so much scrutiny, when there's message boards and social media and talk radio. And, you know, who knows how many people writing about college basketball. You know, 10 years ago, how many people were writing about college basketball on the national level? Like maybe what, one? Maybe? I mean, and that now there's so many of us, and so there's so many eyeballs on everything, and I think that makes it not impossible, but pretty improbable that you could stay at one school for 30 plus years. And so in that respect, I think what Jim was able to accomplish the other night by getting his 900th win, not just as a Division I coach, but his 900th win at Syracuse is probably the last time we ever see that.
See, so a few things hopped into my mind when all this went down. One, it is, I mean, he's been there nearly 40 years as a coach, but you throw an assistant coach and as a player, and it's just about 50 years. It's mind-boggling, okay, that he's done this. We will not see that again. He's gonna hold the record for most wins by a coach basketball D1 men's at one school. I do think he's gonna get to 1,000. He's not made. You know, listen, whereas Patino, there's more of a vague outlook on when he might ultimately retire. Boeheim, more and more now, I do feel like, I've switched on this, I do feel like he's not close. I think he's got minimally 4 years left if everything on that.
If that's the case, Matt, can he possibly catch K? What if K retires in 2 years? Now the Olympic thing is done.
Right.
So what if K retires in 2 years and Boeheim at that point is, right now he's what, 35, he's
like,
36?
Yeah, he's like, right, but you read my mind. Here's the thing. I don't know how much either of those guys, truthfully in their heart, are competitive about this record. I just don't know.
K is completely competitive about
it. Right, and he's younger. I think he's 3 years younger than Boeheim. I don't know, but let's say it did, okay? Let's say that Krzyzewski retired and Boeheim kept going and Boeheim ultimately was like 12 wins ahead of him or something. It's just a hypothetical. Then how is Boeheim perceived? And Gary, what about Casual Hoya, a great Georgetown blog, it pointed out, you know, every instance of Boeheim's players having run-ins with the law, and it's a very long list. Should things like that, should the Bernie Fine stuff, should that stick to Boeheim and his coaching legacy or not? Because with Bob Knight, it almost doesn't. And I don't know if it should or it shouldn't, but it's almost like he is a great coach despite of his reputation and the way that he treated people.
I just don't. I mean, listen, all of that is part of the story, every bit of it, right? Bernie Fine and you know, the arrest within the program. Even this recent thing with Michael Carter Williams, who was very clearly caught stealing, and that Jim tries to talk around it or won't address it, or at the very least is vague. I mean, that happened. And so all of this stuff is part of the story, but unless you're going to hold everybody accountable for the same stuff, I don't think it overshadows anything. I mean, Urban Meyer had a bazillion kids arrested at Florida, but he also won two national championships.
Nobody cares. Nobody cares, ultimately.
At the end of the day, the people who want to use it against you will use it against you. Like, I'm not surprised that a Georgetown blog is the one who decided to put all that stuff out, right? So the people who want to use it against you will use it against you. But for everybody else, Jim Boeheim is just the longtime Syracuse coach who won a hell of a lot of basketball games. The average basketball fan, certainly the average sports fan, doesn't have any idea that they've had arrest issues over his tenure.
Okay. He's an interesting one. He's an original. I think the sport's better for him being in it, and I think there is – I find a lot of parallels, obviously, with Calhoun from conference to age to how long they did it at one school to kind of getting a really good team. Not Syracuse isn't the middle of nowhere, but you got to figure, like, they get so much lake effect snow. Boeheim shared a great story on the Dan Patrick Show the other day where he said we were trying – I don't know when this was, but he's like – Dan asked him, "What is? Give me a good recruiting story." And he was trying to get some kid from California a number of years back. And the kid flew in March, and it happened to be a 55-degree day, which in Syracuse is like freaking tropical. And the kid gets off the plane, and he's like, man, it's so cold here." And Bam was like, "We weren't getting him. I knew it." The next day it was like 21 degrees. They stood no chance. So the fact that he's been able to do this at Syracuse for so long, I think. Sometimes fans just forget how tough it is. Yes, Syracuse is an established program, but it's still, I mean, listen, to do what he did to build that up, it's really impressive. And to me, that's probably what makes him easily a top 10 coach. He wouldn't be near that top five. He'd be behind Calhoun. But when you consider those accomplishments and the fact that he's done it to 900, you know, I don't know. That's why it stands out. Anyway, we can move on here. I thought we had to address Boeheim off the top. Another immediate thing I want to get to that happens Wednesday night. It's been more than a year since the Xavier-Cincinnati Brawl. We don't have to go way into detail, but I did want to address it. I like the fact they kept the rivalry. A lot of rivalries are dying with conference shifting. Obviously, we see what Kansas-Missouri played a great one last year. That one's gone now. So I'm happy they're doing it. They're doing it on a neutral court. It's no longer the Crosstown Shootout. It's the Crosstown Classic presented by... Cincinnati fans, forgive me. I know it's one of your local big-time chili places, so I'm sorry. Anyway, but Goodman, I mean, I'm excited that at least calmer heads prevailed here, and one of college basketball's truly one of its best rivalries. Plenty of people would say this is top five, if not better. It continues with its next iteration on Wednesday night.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, it probably won't be a great game because I think Cincy's a superior team in a neutral environment. Should be, you know, again, you want to see these games continue. I don't think there'll be any issues in this one going forward because I think, you know, everybody will kind of be on their best behavior.
Yes.
And we don't have Yancey Gates and his big right hook.
Okay.
We don't have Two Holloway talking trash and Mark Lyons throwing haymakers that didn't connect and Des Wells pushing. I mean, all the key figures are gone. All of them.
Kenny Freeze and his shiner is gone. Yeah.
Freeze, hopefully his shiner healed up by now and wherever he is in Europe.
Gary, have you ever gone to this rivalry game, by the way? I know you're out there in Memphis. I know it's a little bit north, but...
I've been to Cincinnati and I've been to Xavier, but I've never been to this particular game. And listen, I think last year was more of a product of, you know, some of the individuals who were involved and the officiating crew that didn't keep it under control, as opposed to Xavier and Cincinnati. Like, I know that they're rivals and the fans. I don't think Chris Mack and McCronin hate each other. You know, I mean,
they're not boys, though, that's for sure.
They're not boys because you can't possibly be boys when you coach at those two schools.
Exactly.
But listen, I've been around both of those guys, and listen, we know that Rick and John hate each other, right? And, you know, I don't believe that Chris and Mick, you know, despise each other. And I think they've both done a pretty good job of trying to diffuse some of this to the best that they can and make sure their fans, because that's really, you know, who can get this thing raised to another level. The coaches, I think, have done a decent job of trying to make sure their fans understand, listen, this is, you know, high-stakes stuff in the world of basketball, but it ain't worth punching each other in the face over. And I'm with you guys. I don't think we'll see anything like that again. I suspect you'll see two teams on their best behavior tonight.
You know, this is an interesting podcast. Last week there wasn't a lot of action. I do want to kind of just jump in here and jump in there and just hit on a few things rather quickly. Real quick here, I do want to briefly give you guys a chance to address Butler and Indiana. Indiana was, you know, they're not a great team. Goodman said on Seth Davis's Courtside Show, both of you guys were on it. By the way, Gary, fiance loves your glasses look, so you've got that. You've got that endorsement, but Goodman said
he's marrying Norlander Paris, so
that's take that.
Exactly. So listen, take it with the utmost grain of the tiniest bit of salt. But you know, Goodman, you said, listen, Indiana's clumped in with everyone else. There's no elite team. Personally, I just took more away from with Butler. It was just another win to prove that Butler is. It's not. I think now even casual fans are realizing that they can embrace Butler, but more and more it's just becoming a power team. First win in the regular season over a number one team, and the game itself was awesome. I just love the fact that we had such a kick-ass game again in December. I had flashbacks to Indiana-Kentucky because this was, again, mid-December, late afternoon game, you know, really good, really close, really late.
I was busy watching the Arizona football comeback.
Okay.
You know, switching between the two.
Naturally.
But listen. Yes, it says a lot about Butler and how great a coach Brad Stevens is. We knew this, but I think we almost kind of forgot in the last year because Butler wasn't great last season, didn't get in the NCAA tournament. And then this year, maybe their best player, Kashawn Hopkins, gets tossed off the team in the preseason. They don't really have a guy that can beat you off the bounce, and they go in and they beat Indiana in a pro Hoosiers crowd in Indianapolis. But I don't know. I think it says more about, again, the state of college basketball. You know, we knew Brad Stevens was a phenomenal head coach, but I think a lot of people thought Indiana was this rise above the rest because they were number one or AP put them number one. And, you know, they had Cody Zeller and the best player in the country. Well, Cody Zeller hasn't played like the best player in the country. And Christian Watford hasn't gotten any better. And as I've always said, he's the poor man's Terrence Jones. That's what he is. I mean, Gary and I have seen him for probably 5 or 6 years, dating back to on the AU circuit. Gary, is he any different than he was 5 years ago?
Who are we talking about?
Christian Watford.
Yeah, Watford Parrish. Go ahead.
They're not.
I think he's different than he was last year. At least he's statistically different.
Oh, he's no different.
He's statistically different.
Whatever. You're statistically different, but you're no different.
I love Goodman laying out his argument. Parrish is like, yeah, dude, what are you saying right now?
You know, like, honestly, I was reading a story. A 2-year-old got shot in Memphis here. So I was looking at this story. So
focus, Parrish. Focus.
Yeah.
Not one of your strengths.
I'm sorry. I tend to get distracted these days by kids getting shot.
Understandable. But in terms of Indiana, Parrish, I don't know. A lot of people want to – the thing I like about college hoops is we do our best and we don't do what football does. We don't overreact. You know, some of that's built into the fact that there are more games and there's a tournament and all that good stuff. But I still – to me, Indiana is still the top three of overall well-balanced teams. I know there's arguments.
Of course. Listen, you know, I think we all knew, because we all talked about it and wrote about it, that there was going to be no clear-cut, dominant, you know, Kentucky last year team, Carolina in 09 team, Kansas in 08, or Memphis in 08 team. There were going to be some college basketball teams that were better than the other college basketball teams, but nobody who compared to some of the great teams we've seen over the past decade. And so I think this is a byproduct of that. I mean, the number one team in the country is somebody we didn't think, or a lot of people didn't think, would finish in the top three of the ACC this year. You know, the Indiana team that was a lot of people's number one, at least number one in the AP and coaches poll, is a team that just got beat by a team that got run off the court by a Xavier team that was picked, I believe, eighth or ninth in the A-10 in the preseason. So this is, I think, what we're going to deal with this college basketball season. At some point, Duke's going to take a couple losses it shouldn't take, and so is Louisville. And
how many teams at the end of the year you think end up in the number one spot at one point or another? 5 or 6?
It could. There was one year where we actually did that. Like, we changed number one in the country like 4 out of 5 weeks or something a few years ago. But I mean, clearly we've already had Indiana. We've got Louisville now.
Yeah.
But I mean, no, we got
Michigan. Michigan could be number one. Syracuse could be number one.
You could see even Kansas getting up there at some point. I do think this is a year where we're going to probably see 4, 5, or 6, number one teams in the country.
All right. What about Miami real quick here? This is now becoming a thing. Miami's the second-best team in the ACC. I don't believe that. Goodman, you're on that bandwagon, right?
Well, I talked to Durant Scott last night after their win. They absolutely crushed Central Florida at Central Florida. Not that Central Florida is a great team. They don't have a ton of depth, not eligible for the postseason, so a few of their players ended up bolting. But I do think this Miami starting five is pretty darn good. You know, Shane Larkin, Barry Larkin's kid at the point. Durant Scott is back. Remember, their only loss came without him against Florida Gulf Coast. Reggie Johnson's a man. And then, to be honest, I mean, you got Kenny Kodge, who's playing really well. So they've got some players on this team, four in particular, that could go for 15 or 20 on any given night, and they're playing well together. Remember last year, and Durant Scott said this to me last night, last year was a tough year for him because they didn't know. They had these things kind of hanging over their head of whether they were going to be suspended, whether they wouldn't. Durant Scott got hit at the end of the year, wasn't eligible to play the final three games, one of which in the ACC tournament that probably knocked them out of contention from an NCAA tournament bid. And again, you're a Daquan Jones, what he went through. You're dealing with a first-year head coach in Jim Larrañaga. And it was a tough situation for them emotionally that, you know, to handle all this stuff. And I think they're more equipped now. I like their starting five. I'm not ready to say they're the number two team in the ACC. But you know what? We don't know who the number two team is today in the ACC, and we're not even sure Duke's going to be number one at the end of the day. Certainly, they've played the part of that so far.
I think Duke will be. I think it's a bad sign for the ACC if there's that much uncertainty. I think, you know, Carolina is going to be down a little bit. NC State should be up. Miami's fine. Don't get me wrong. Just because Miami's number two doesn't mean I'm totally down on the ACC if, in fact, that's the case. But man, if that's not, you know, Gary, if that's not a microcosm to what we just talked about with, you know, if there's that much uncertainty in a league like the ACC, then, you know, maybe college basketball in its season is just lurching a little bit along right now. And we had the good Indiana-Butler game, and Maui was decent. We had some decent stuff. But it does feel overall, right, like we're kind of waiting for things to kick into, like, fourth or fifth gear.
Well, we don't have – usually, and maybe it doesn't happen until around January, but we get this, you know, one story out of nowhere that we didn't really expect, and then this one team out of nowhere – that we really didn't expect. And to date, I don't know that we have that too much. I mean,
Duke's out of nowhere in a sense that Duke nobody had him being a top 10 team and really in the preseason other than, you know, maybe your guy, Mike DeCourcy.
They were a top 15 team. I mean, right. I'm not
number one. I mean, they came out of nowhere to be.
Yeah, but it's Duke. I mean, for us, yeah, it's out of nowhere. But for people that pick up on college hoops and track the three or four things, you know, it's business as usual. It's just like if a casual college football fan looks up and Alabama was supposed to be, you know, the 13th best team, but by the way, oh yeah, here it is, 9-0 again. It's just business as usual.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can go out of nowhere with Duke, even though it is, we're surprised that they're ranked where they're ranked. But, you know, if we're sitting here on December 19th talking about a Miami, you know, spending time on a national podcast talking about Miami, which is still unranked today, that suggests that the storylines that we like in college basketball haven't really materialized yet. But I do think in terms of Miami, you know, usually we talk about they might, you know, right now we're talking about they might be the second best team in the ACC, or we're at least debating whether they are. Typically, that's off the table for everybody. You know, typically it's Duke and Carolina are going to be 1 and 2. And now you try to figure out if you can get the third. And so the idea that second is even attainable for a program or a team like Miami speaks to the shakiness of Carolina and even NC State to some degree. And so I actually wrote, you know, we didn't rank Miami in the preseason, but in the ACC preview, I actually, you know, you started looking at this roster and looking at what they were bringing back and looking at the rest of the ACC, and you said, oh, you know, look, like if it's possible to get excited about Miami basketball, and I'm not sure that it is in Miami, but this might be the season to do it because they could break through, and through eight games, it looks like they're on track to do that.
Goodman, I want to give you the chance to real quick here talk about you went to that Arizona-Florida game, which was the game of the weekend heading in. It was still a really good game. It wasn't quite as good as IU-Butler, but, got sloppy at the end there, plenty dramatic. Any takeaway? I mean, you've seen Florida in person now twice, and Arizona's a team people still don't know a lot about. Inform the listeners what they should know now about both these teams and what you saw or learned.
Well, that Arizona is probably not worthy. They certainly don't look like a number four team in the country yet. Let's put it that way. Could they get there by the end of the year? Yes. They didn't play well at all, and they're going to be a work in progress because they don't have a true point guard. They don't have anybody to make those freshman big guys better. And they're talented. Brandon Ashley, Grant Jarrett, Caleb Tarzewski, all talented kids. But you know what? It's hard without a guy to kind of make their life easier. It's going to be hard for them to kind of mature and improve throughout the season. It was more, to be honest, a reflection of Florida. And I'm still kind of befuddled at Billy Donovan not putting the ball in Scotty Wilbekin's hands a little bit more down the stretch. I mean, he knows what Kenny Boynton is. He's seen it for 3.5 years. And I know Wilbekin had the broken finger, but I still would have the ball glued to his hands in the final minute of the game and not put it in Kenny Boynton's hands because you just frankly don't know what the heck he's going to do with it.
Okay, good deal. I'm liking this kind of rapid-fire thing. Hey, Gary, right there in Memphis, Pastner still hasn't beaten a top 25 team. Amazing stat to me. Until you pointed it out over the weekend, did not realize that was the case. And for everyone that's listening that's in the Memphis area or is a Memphis fan, I know you're all too aware of it. And it's just a bad look. Conference USA is just dreadful. Give us a temperature reading here. This is this is your annual, your weekly Memphis update brought to you by Gary Parrish and all of his loyal followers.
I would say that the statistic is Memphis hasn't beaten a top 25 team since February 7, 2009. That's when John Calipari was the coach and they beat Mark Few and Gonzaga. Since then they've played 11 top 25 teams. They are 0-11, most recently the loss to Louisville at home on Saturday. And though I think some people try to take that statistic and make it mean something it doesn't, which is, Josh can't coach or Josh isn't getting it done or anything like that, which is all untrue. I mean, the guy has made the past two NCAA tournaments. He's consistently signed elite level recruiting classes, and he's going to run away with Conference USA again. Although, to you guys' point, that doesn't mean a thing. And I think that's the larger issue and why Saturday's loss hurt is because when you start to get these bullet point statistics attached to your career, positive or negative, they have an effect. In other words, somebody will say, John Calipari puts 5 guys into the NBA draft or whatever it is, right? Well, these things are things that just get repeated over and over and over again, and they become part of your story. They become connected to your name. With Josh, that statistic right now is 0-11 against the top 25. And here's the issue. If you coach in any other league or any power league in the country, that you're 0-11 all time against the top 25 on December 19th doesn't mean much because you're going to get an opportunity to fix that on January, February, March. Well, at Memphis and Conference USA, you don't. So unless they get into the NCAA tournament and then happen to play a top 25 team and then happen to beat that top 25 team, he's going to enter the fifth year as a head coach with 0 wins against the top 25. So the complaint in the city, to the extent that there is a complaint, and there is, I mean, let's not hide from it, is that great guy, recruits like crazy, terrific in the community, but he has lost games that he's not supposed to lose, and he has never to date won a game that he wasn't supposed to win, unless you count the 2011 Conference USA Championship game against UTEP in El Paso, and that was a UTEP team that wasn't ranked. And so, they still got players. They're still going to roll through Conference USA. They're still going to win 26, 27, 28 games, get in the NCAA tournament. But this has become an issue in the town.
What if they don't win the conference tournament this year? What if they go, how many games are in Conference USA? 16?
I think it's,
What if they have one or two losses?
Yeah.
Okay. And they beat Tennessee. They beat Harvard. Who they have left on their schedule, non-conference, which look great right now. And they lose two conference games. Do you put them in?
Oh, they are shaping up right now to end up on the bubble. Because in reality, you can run a league table. I mean, John did it for, a handful of years in a row. But that's not likely, not with this team. And so they're going to lose somewhere they're not supposed to lose. And probably they'll be underdogs in Knoxville. I don't know that they'll lose the game, but they'll be underdogs there, and they'll be maybe a slight favorite or a slight underdog at Xavier.
Kind of a big game. The Tennessee game could turn out to be a big game for them.
Well, it is. I don't even want to say it's possible. I think it's likely they end up on Selection Sunday with a handful of losses they shouldn't have and no good wins. And if that's the case, and you don't get the automatic bid,
yep.
Yeah, you're sweating it out probably.
Yeah, they're putting themselves in that situation right now because they don't have a bad loss. VCU, Minnesota, Louisville are not bad losses. If they lose to Tennessee, it's not a bad loss, but they don't have the opportunity for good wins. Their best win right now, neutral against Northern Iowa or home against Ohio, who just gave Winthrop its first win of the season a few days ago. So I think, you know, I think Memphis has got to minimally lose one game in CUSA if it loses to Tennessee to have any sort of chance at a realistic bubble shot. And we're not going to realignment, I promise. But this is why Memphis wanted to get out of this league, and then why Memphis fans are obviously so frustrated with.
Well, it's just like being a baseball player. You know, you want more at bats. You know, if you only get, you know, 11 at bats over a 4-year period, which is essentially what we're talking about. As long as you,
I think you're talking about wiffle ball here, but yes, go ahead.
As long as you let me talk, compare at bats to games against top 25 teams. You know, you might go 0-11, and let's be honest, you shouldn't be 0-11. I mean, that's a bad number. But, you know, you'd rather have 30 at-bats. And when you get into a new league, even though this new Big East isn't going to be what we thought it was, you're going to get more at-bats and then probably connect a little bit more. But to date, again, the number's the number. The record's the record. It's 0-11 against the top 25, and that's an issue that not only affects the way he's perceived, maybe not nationally, but certainly within the city. But it also it affects the way this year is going to be judged on Selection Sunday, if they have to be judged on Selection Sunday. Again, there's only two ways they get, you know, this is either they're going to get the automatic bid and a bad seed that puts you at a disadvantage to try to advance, or they're going to be sweating it out on Selection Sunday. I think those are the two most likely scenarios at this moment.
All right, guys. Hey, listen, I appreciate this. Christmas just around the corner. This is our last podcast before the day, although Goodman just finished celebrating Hanukkah. So did that go well, buddy? Did you enjoy your Hanukkah?
Merry Christmas. My daughter did enjoy Hanukkah. She's right here. She got some presents, and we're giving her the day off from school today because she's commuting for 3 weeks. We've commuted her an hour and a half to and from school. So it's been a rough stretch. It's almost done, and looking forward to some downtime, you know, a couple non-basketball days coming up around Christmas.
I know. I like to actually enhance the discourse on the podcast, and maybe next week, you know, me, Parrish, and your daughter instead. That might be
She's up for it. She's nodding her head right now that she would love to join the podcast. She knows a whole lot more than I think either of you guys about Boston College basketball.
I don't doubt that whatsoever. I don't doubt that whatsoever. Gary, you all prepped and ready for this, or are you? I think we talked about this last year. I mean, are you at the mall on the 24th? Is that going to be you wandering around?
I let Kelly handle all the shopping. I don't really get involved in it.
But what about for her? She doesn't shop for her.
Well, she probably needs to at this point because we're running out of time.
Okay. All right. Good stuff.
No, I'm actually in a bad spot. Here's the spot. So her best friend, you ready for this? How do you handle this? All right. So her best friend's husband, like, is the nicest guy in the world, which already puts me in just a bad spot because you're constantly compared to somebody who's just a better human than you are. So her best friend, guess what she gets for Christmas the other day? She comes – her husband goes, hey, sweetheart, I'm going to take your car to get an oil change, which just, A, is something I'd never do. Like, get your own damn oil change. I'll get my oil change. You get your oil change. But he's like, hey, sweetheart, I'm going to go get your oil change in your car. Give me your keys. She says, okay. This dude comes back home with a brand new Mercedes with a bow on it. That's her Christmas present.
Hold on. Like, just like the commercials, like the straight up the big bow?
Yes. All right? Yes. So now, like, what am I?
I want him as my husband.
I know. I'll sleep with you, you know, for a brand new Mercedes. So what can I do now, right? Anything short of like a private jet, I've been disappointed. it's an awful position to be in. Like what could I possibly do now?
Oh man, nice people are just the worst.
Hey, sweetheart, here's your new iPad 3. Like, what am I supposed to do now? Like, this.
I got a suggestion for you. Go get a makeover.
I don't even know what that means.
He's hating on the glasses, man.
And
the scarf.
Listen, I got to run here.
I know. Listen, you do have to run. He's got a radio interview. We'll wrap it up here. Appreciate it so much. Friday we'll have Clark Kellogg. Great stuff, Gary. Great stuff, Goodman. We'll talk to you soon.